Hello, this is the Physics 142 lecture for November 13th, 2008. I'm sitting in a hotel room out by Fermilab, and I imagine my neighbors in the hotel, if they can hear me, are going to be thinking, my God, I'm glad I'm not watching that television station. At any rate, you need to open the PDF file labeled P142-110608, and hopefully that's on the website and you can find it. I'd like to remind you that we have our exam on Thursday, November 13th. It'll be class time in Hoyt. It is okay to bring a 3x5 index card with anything you want written on it. I will supply you with a formula sheet. I will try to post that before the exam after I make out the exam, but that's not done yet, so I don't know quite when it'll show up. The other thing I'd like to do is to give you the opportunity to ask questions and have a question and answer session. It will have to be Monday because unfortunately I have to go out of town again next week. It's a little crazy this couple of weeks. So that means the Q&A session will have to be Monday afternoon, and I haven't come to closure on that with Janet to get a room yet, but when I do, I'll try to let you know what's going on. So if you have opened up the PDF file with the lecture notes on it and look at page 1, I'd like to remind you about some of the things that we did last time. We looked at circuits with different combinations of circuit elements, and now life is richer because we have more than just resistors and capacitors. We now have these inductors. And last time, you recall that we looked at the combination of an inductor and a resistor in a circuit hooked across an EMF, and you can think of this as a standard EMF, like a DC battery. And if you do a voltage sum around the loop, you will get a differential equation which you can solve for the current, and we did that last time. And when we solved it for the current, we got the equation specified by the capital A in a circle. The current is equal to the EMF over the resistance, which is basically the limiting value of the current, because V is equal to IR, basically, or EMF is equal to IR, so that you know once the current has settled down, that's got to be the asymptotic current. Or another way to think about it is you have an EMF drop across the inductor that goes as the change in the current with respect to time. So once the current has settled down and it's not changing with respect to time, there is no EMF drop across the inductor, and basically you have the EMF just across the resistor, and that gives you the current I. So if we look at the solution for I, what I'm saying is that at large T, the second term is negligible. Right. So what we have, though, is a rise in the current, which the rate of rise is given by the time constant T sub L. And in this case, the time constant is equal to L over R, because that's what gives you the that's the piece that normalizes the time in the exponential part of the expression. So it's very similar to what we've seen for charging capacitors. At any rate, if I plot I versus T, then on the graph at the bottom of the page, you see with the blue curve the rising exponential form of this current. And the degree of the rise will depend on T sub L. For small T sub L, it rises much faster because basically the exponential in the second term turns off much faster. So if we now short the circuit across the inductor and the resistor, we go to page 2, the EMF is no longer in the system, but I want you to imagine that we had the EMF in the system, so that basically we had the inductor. It's not quite fair to say it's charged, but let's just say that we have had we had current flowing in the circuit, so we have a full magnetic field in the inductor, and now we take the EMF out of the system, and basically we have that magnetic field that has to dissipate. And so initially at T equals zero, we have a current, which would be basically the same current we had on page one, asymptotically, but now it will drop off exponentially. So if you, again, do a Kirchhoff law sum around the elements of the circuit element, a voltage sum, set it equal to zero, you'll get a differential equation, which you can solve. We looked at that last time, and you find that the current drops off exponentially, again, with a characteristic time scale, which is equal to this T sub L. So you have both the inductor and the resistor still in the circuit, so you still have that characteristic time element, time constant. If T sub L is very large, then it drops off slowly. If it's small, it drops off very fast. Life gets a little more interesting if we look at page 2 in the middle. If we look at an element where we have an LC circuit, again, if we just plop down a circuit with a capacitor in it and an inductor in it, it's not going to do anything very exciting. So you imagine that basically we've charged up the capacitor and we hook it across an inductor as a way to think about it. And in this case, the most straightforward way to look at the system is to actually examine the energy in the circuit. We know that the total energy in the circuit is going to be the energy in the magnetic field plus the energy in the electric field, the magnetic field being basically in the inductor and the electric field being in the capacitor. And our standard form for those, for the magnetic field, goes as 1/2 Li squared in the inductor, and in the capacitor, the electric field is going to go as Q squared over 2C. So these are things that we know and we've seen. So in order to understand the time behavior of this, we take the derivative of the energy with respect to time, basically look at the power. Since there's no resistor in the circuit, there's nothing to dissipate the energy, which means that the change in the total energy of the circuit is, with respect to time, has to be zero. And if we then take the derivative of the right-hand side of the energy equation, which I label with a large green B in a circle. We take the time derivative of the right-hand side, we get the equation given by the C in a circle at the bottom. So 0 is equal to the second derivative of the charge with respect to time, times L, plus Q over C. Which I guess we did last time. Basically, you do get a DIDT in there, which cancels. So if you take the derivative of the right-hand side, you'll find that the bottom equation holds true, and now we have a differential equation. And if we, last time we looked at that carefully, and we saw, you can see that it's a harmonic equation, and when you recognize an equation as harmonic, you basically know the time dependence of the variable in the equation, and you can write down the frequency. You know that the variable, in this case the charge, is going to vary harmonically, and you can write down the harmonic function, and we know what the frequency is. And to convince yourself of this, you can go and think your way through a simple spring derivation from mechanics and see that it's true. Or at least that's the way I usually think about it. At any rate, so last time we wrote down the equation, and in this case, if we go to the top of page 3, the charge as a function of time is going to be equal to some Q, big Q, some sort of amplitude charge, the maximum charge you get across the capacitor, basically, and it's going to vary harmonically with a frequency omega, which is given by 1 over the square root of LC. And if we want to think about the energy flow, then we can write down expressions for the energy in the capacitor and the energy in the magnetic field in the inductor. So for the energy in the electric field in the capacitor, I have an A in a circle, shows the equation, and for the energy in the inductor in the magnetic field, I'll give a B in a green B in a circle. So as always, the energy in the electric field is going to be Q squared over 2C, and we now have how Q varies with a function of time, so we simply substitute in that expression. And for the magnetic field, it's 1/2 Li squared, so we take the time derivative of the charge to get the current, and we square it, and we put that in equation B. And you can see the behaviors. And one of the things that's very interesting is that, first of all, the harmonic functions are squared, so basically the electric field varies from zero up to a value of large Q squared over 2C, which makes sense because that is the maximal, big Q is the maximal charge that you can have across the capacitor. So at any given time, the maximal electric field is going to be big Q squared over 2C. And it varies harmonically, like the square of the cosine function. And for the magnetic field, we have the same thing. We have what you would expect for the limiting value. But I'm sorry, for the maximal value. But you'll note that it's a sine square instead of cosine square. So these two things are exactly out of phase, which really means that the energy as a function of time is flowing between one element to the other. So if we go to page 4, you see the drawings that we had last time where you see the electric field and the magnetic field. Basically, the energy flows back and forth from the electric field to the magnetic field. And you can sort of think of the charge basically oscillating from one side of the capacitor and then flipping around and going to the other side of the capacitor. And on the way, we have a large change in current in the inductor, which gives you the magnetic field. And there's nothing in this problem to get rid of the energy, so what we have is just oscillations of the charge back and forth. So we call these LC oscillations. And this will happen with a characteristic frequency, which is omega equals 1 over the square root of LC. So this is a very important result, because what it tells us is that circuits with capacitance and inductance will have basically a characteristic oscillation that will take place. Okay, so that basically ends what we were doing at the end of class last time. Now what I'd like to do is to move to page 5 and look at AC circuits. To some extent, this follows Ohanian's treatment, because I liked the treatment Ohanian did in the last edition of his textbook. I noticed this morning, in fact, when I was looking through the newer edition of Ohanian, that some aspects of the treatment has changed, particularly toward the end of the chapter. I'm not sure I like it as much, but it's probably a little bit more conventional. At any rate, I don't typically give lectures where I follow necessarily what's going on in the textbook. I don't mean to do that to confuse you. The spirit that I have is I try to pick a textbook that's good, that will work well for you to read and add, give you some clarity on many of the topics that we cover. And at the same time, I then will develop my treatment from either what I know or various other textbooks, and I'll take things that I like, and I'll try to give sort of an independent view of the same topic. This is one where, if I recall, I pretty much decided I liked how Ohanian did it in the last edition, and I pretty much follow that. My guess is a lot of this follows what you have in your current text, too. At any rate, so on page 5, I want to start talking about AC circuits. So DC stands for direct current, and think of a battery that basically gives you an EMF across two terminals that is stable with respect to time. An AC circuit is a situation where you have an EMF that varies with time. In particular, we're going to assume that the EMF varies sinusoidally with time with a characteristic frequency, which is given by omega. Now, remember that it's very important in physics to use the same symbol for as many things as possible to maintain the highest degree of confusion possible for the general public. In this case, what you'll note is I've used omega again, and we had omega on the last page and the page before that. The omega that I'm talking about now is different. The omega we had a moment ago was the frequency of the characteristic oscillations of the LC circuit. Now I'm not necessarily talking about LC or anything. I'm basically talking about the frequency with which the EMF is sinusoidally changing across the poles of the battery. So imagine having a battery where the voltage across the terminals goes like a sine, which means it goes like a sine wave, which means it even flips sine, right? So you have plus 1.5 volts going one way, and then it slowly reduces and goes to 1.5 volts going the other way, and this happens basically in the form of a sine. The reason this comes into play so often is that a great way to construct a nice EMF or a generator, if you will, is to take a loop of wire and rotate it in a magnetic field. And by virtue of the rotation, you're actually changing the magnetic flux through the loop. And that will change sinusoidally if you analyze the problem, which basically will give you an EMF that changes sinusoidally from Faraday's law. So that's the basic idea. At any rate, so in an AC circuit, we have the EMF varying sinusoidally with a maximal value, which I'll just write down as epsilon max. If we now do a voltage sum around the loop, as usual, EMF minus IR is equal to zero, we know that the current at any time across the resistor will be given by the EMF over R, and that will vary sinusoidally. Just like we've had, because V is equal to IR is always true, and if the EMF is changing, or V is changing sinusoidally, your current's going to change. So equation A shows what the current will be through the resistor as a function of time if it's put across this particular sinusoidally varying EMF. If we think about how the power goes in this circuit, because we have current going through a resistor, we will have power dissipated, and at any given moment it will go as the current times the EMF. That will also vary sinusoidally, but in this case, both the current and the EMF contain the sine function, so the power will vary as a sine squared. So if we look at the power on the graph below, basically, we find that the instantaneous power dissipation will look like a sine square curve with a characteristic frequency, omega, and you'll have a maximal value, which will be basically the power dissipation that you have when the current is at a maximum. So it shouldn't surprise you that if the EMF is varying with time, that the power dissipated through the resistor will vary with time. This is important, right? If you're putting a light bulb in an AC circuit, you do need to worry about what the maximal power output will be. If a very short burst of very high power is going to melt the filament in the bulb, then the bulb is going to burn out. But what is often more relevant is not so much the instantaneous power output or power dissipation in a circuit, but the average power dissipation in the circuit. So if you're concerned about what your power bill is going to be over the period of a month, as opposed to whether some peak power is going to melt an element in your circuit, or if you're concerned about even though your circuit can handle Let's think of a computer, for example. Although often we have transformers that switch things into DC, but imagine you have a circuit that's in an enclosed area, and the circuit itself can handle a peak power dissipation, so pieces of it don't melt due to instantaneous power output. But in time, that power basically is coming out as heat. It's resisted heating, and the temperature in the enclosure is going to increase. And so you better have a good idea of what the average power output will be if you want to calculate what the temperature of your enclosure will be, for example. So there are many instances where the average power is more important than the instantaneous power. Although I guess they're both important at any rate. We're going to make use of the fact that the average of a sine squared function over a period is 1/2. So now the sine squared omega t term, if we average out over time, is just basically going to be equal to 1/2. So the average power output is going to be Emax squared over 2R. Now in this same circuit, if we go to page 6, in this same circuit, we've already seen that the time dependence of the current is exactly in phase with the time dependence of the EMF. So on the graph at the top of page 6, I plot the EMF in blue, and it starts out at 0 as a function of time because it goes as a sine function. And you see it sinusoidally varying with a maximum value, which is epsilon max. If I now plot the current on the same graph, the current goes as Emax over R, so the magnitude is smaller because it's divided out by the magnitude of the resistance divided by that. But everything is in phase, so the drawing isn't perfect, but the current is meant to follow exactly the same sinusoidal time behavior as we have with the EMF. We say that the two are in phase. So now I'd like to go to the middle of page 6 and look at an AC circuit where the AC EMF is now put across a capacitor rather than a resistor. In this case, we know that the charge across the capacitor is always going to be the capacitance times the EMF, which means the charge across the capacitor is going to vary, again, sinusoidally. So the charge goes as the capacitance times epsilon max times sine omega t. We take the time derivative of that to get the current in the circuit. So the current will go as omega C Emax cosine omega T. In this case, you see the behavior is really quite different from what we had across the resistor in that the charge on the resistor and the current are out of phase. The EMF and the current are now out of phase. So if I now at the bottom of page 6, if I plot the EMF as a function of time, I have exactly the same curve as I had at the top of page 6, the dark blue curve, because that's the same EMF. But if I now look at the current in the circuit with the capacitor in it, it is going to look like a cosine omega t function. So things are out of phase. So the way that this is drawn, the lingo is you say that the current leads the EMF by a quarter of a period. So the way to think about that is if you look at t equals 0, you'll see that the current is maximal when the EMF is minimal, and then in a quarter period it's the other way around. So a way to think about it is that the EMF is following the current. It's a bit of a convention here because you could imagine saying it the other way, but I don't know. I don't really like the terminology very much. To me, the graphical piece speaks for itself. So what you'll see I mean, what you see is that the current and the EMF are out of phase by 90 degrees. Okay. Now there's another piece here in the resistive circuit that we talked about on page 5 and 6. We have a resistor in the circuit. Okay. So that makes sense. In the capacitive circuit, let's look at the situation. You'll note in the middle of page 6 where I have the equation for the current beside a large A in a green circle, you see that the current is proportional to something that really does look like the EMF. It may be out of phase with the EMF, but it's sort of like the EMF. And we know that in a normal circuit, the way that we're used to thinking about it, we have that the EMF is equal to I times the resistance, or the EMF is proportional to the current. So if we look at equation A in the middle of page 6, you see that I is proportional to something that's like the EMF with a proportionality constant that looks like omega C. So omega C basically plays a role of resistance in a capacitive AC circuit. So if we go to the top of page 7, I said omega C is 1 over omega C, right? So if we take at the top of page 7 and we rewrite the equation that we had in the middle of page 6, we can see that the right-hand side is basically something that is the EMF, or it's out of phase, but it's basically the EMF of the circuit. The left-hand side is the current times a constant. And if we can think of that constant basically as a resistance. So 1 over omega C plays the role of a resistance in a capacitive AC circuit. And in fact, it's given the name capacitive reactance, which has the symbol of chi sub C. Okay. Now, if we go to the middle of page 7, I want to take our third circuit element and put it across, individually, across a sinusoidally varying EMF. So I want to look at an inductive AC circuit. In this case, if we do Kirchhoff's law, so down on the left-hand side below the circuit diagram, EMF minus L di over dt is equal to 0, then we can rewrite this to solve for di dt and substitute in what the EMF is, which is epsilon max times sine omega t. Then we can, basically we have di is equal to dt times epsilon max sine omega t over L. So we basically now integrate both sides. We'll find that the E is equal to minus epsilon max cosine omega t over omega L. The reason for that is because the integral of sine omega t is minus cosine omega t over omega. Now we can, in the middle of page 7, plot a graph. Again, the EMF is given by the blue, and it varies sinusoidally with a characteristic frequency omega. If I now look at how the current goes, in this case, the current, again, is out of phase with the EMF, but it also has a sine flip. So we basically have to draw the current as a cosine curve and flip the sign. So you can see the current given by the orange curve as a function of time. In this case, if we go by the same kind of convention we had on page 6 in terms of what we say lags, in this case, the current lags the EMF instead of the EMF or instead of leading the EMF, because it's sort of on the other side of the peak in the current is on the other side of the EMF relative to what we saw with the capacitive circuit. Again, in this case, we have the current proportional to something that looks like the EMF, and in this case, the piece, the constant that acts like a resistance is going to be the omega L. So we define omega L as, the way to think about it is the omega L is the resistance, is what acts like resistance in an AC inductive circuit. But we don't call it inductive resistance or something like that, because we have to make up new words to keep things very complicated. So we call omega L the inductive reactance, and it's given a symbol chi sub L. So if we go to the top of page 8, basically I'm just writing what I said a moment ago, where omega L is equal to chi sub L. That's just a rewriting of the equation at the bottom of page 7. Okay. Well, now we have all of the pieces. We've seen the behavior of individual elements in an AC circuit, and as we experienced with the DC circuit, a lot of the fun really begins when you start to couple together different combinations of elements. So the most general way to look at it would be to actually take an AC EMF, an alternating EMF, and put it across an inductor, a capacitor, and a resistance all in series. And we call this the LRC circuit. In this case, so we're at the we're basically just below the top on page 8. The EMF goes as epsilon max sine omega t, because that's how I've defined my EMF in all of these problems. It's just sinusoidally varying. And what do we know about the current? Well, what we've seen in every instance so far is that we have the current also varies harmonically, and it will have some maximum value, and it may have a phase difference relative to the EMF. Okay, we saw for the resistor that they were in phase, and we saw for the capacitor and the inductive circuits where you have those elements by themselves, it's out of phase by 90 degrees in different ways. So we're going to write down the current as I max times sine omega t plus phi, where phi is some unknown phase and the I max is some unknown maximum current. And then the question is, can we basically find out what I max and phi happen to be? All right. Sorry, I'm making an adjustment on the slides here. Okay, so now we go to page 9. How do we think our way through this? You imagine that in the circuit, the current is going to be the current at any given moment through all three of the circuit elements. That we know. All right? And so what I would like to do is to imagine that I have the same current through each of the circuit elements at some given time. And I would like to ask, given that, what is the EMF, or what is the voltage drop across each of the circuit elements at that given moment? So what I really mean is, what we have done earlier is we plotted the EMF for each of the elements and asked how does the current look given that EMF curve. So on page 9, just to remind you, for the resistor across an EMF, we have the EMF curve and the orange current curve are in phase. For the capacitor, we have the same EMF curve and the current is out of phase. For the inductor, we have the same EMF curve and the current is out of phase, but it's the other direction. Okay, so these graphs on page 9 are just the three graphs that you've already seen for the individual elements. What I'd like to do now is to basically take the same current curve and ask, what does that mean for the EMF across each of these circuit elements? So if we go to page 10, and you may have to go back and forth between page 10 and page 9 for this to make sense. The light blue curve is, I'll just say, is the current in the circuit, okay? And now what I'd like to do is to ask, given that current curve, what does the EMF look like across each of these elements using the behavior that we saw on page 9? So, I'd like to call your attention to the blue curve at the top of page 10, where I'm plotting the current as a function of time. And in this case, I've defined that the current here is going to be a sine curve. Given that current in a circuit, which is the behavior of a current that you'll have in an LRC circuit, we know it'll vary sinusoidally, and we're just defining this to be the current in the circuit. Let's ask, what does the EMF look like across each of the elements? So for the resistor, for example, if you go to the top of page 10, we see that the EMF in the resistor is in phase with the current. So if you go to the graph at the top of page 10, you see the orange curve is a curve that is in phase with the current. And I'll have the orange curve represent the EMF across the resistor. Don't worry about the fact that what its amplitude is. What I'm trying to do here is to get an idea of how the phases work and not so much an idea about the amplitudes here. I basically just want to see, I'm trying to figure out how we quantify the voltage drop across each of these detector elements at the same time. All right, so now we, I hope, understand the blue curve, which is the current, and the orange curve, which is the EMF across the resistor, and you see that they are in phase. Okay, now let's consider the capacitor, which will be the pink curve on the graph on top of page 10. If we look at, on page 9, the middle graph, what we see is that relative to the current, the EMF is out of phase, and I guess you could say it's, you have to add 90 degrees to get to the EMF. So, if we look at the capacitive curve, relative to the current, the EMF curve is basically shifted by 90 degrees to the right. Similarly, for the inductive curve at the bottom of page 9, I have to shift it by 90 degrees to the left relative to the current. So the red curve on the top of page 10 would be the way the EMF will act across the inductor if I have the current in the blue curve. The pink is the way the EMF will act across the capacitor if I have the current in the blue curve. And the orange is how the EMF will be across the resistor given the current in the blue curve. Okay? You may have to stop the recording and think about this a little bit. It took me a few minutes to sort through it. Given all of this, how do we do a voltage sum as we go around the loop to get an equation that defines the behavior of the circuit as a function of time? Well, imagine what we have given. I mean, now that we have these curves, at any given time, the voltage drop across the resistor, which I call delta V sub R, is going to go as a sine omega t plus phi. If the EMF goes as sine omega t plus phi, the resistor will be in phase. For the capacitor, okay, so look at t equals 0 on the curve on page 10, and you see that we have the current defined as a sine omega t. And in this case, the phase angle is 0 in this particular example curve. At the very same instant, you'll see that the resistor also looks like a sine curve, and it's in phase. So that's why the first term goes as a sine omega t plus phi. The second term represents the voltage drop across the capacitor, and if you look at the pink curve, when the current looks like a sine, the pink curve looks like a negative cosine. So that's why the second term comes in as a minus cosine omega t plus phi. And the inductor will look like a cosine when the current looks like a sine. And it will be positive. So, and we have to have the appropriate constants so that we're talking about EMF in each of these three terms. So as we do a voltage sum across the three circuit elements, you get the behavior that I point out in the equation for the EMF in the middle of page 10. So this was a rather convoluted discussion, and it, to me, has always been a little fuzzy to think about it. There are other ways to think about it. People often use a graphical analysis where they basically construct vectors that rotate in time in a plane for the current and the EMF. And they call these quantities phasors. This idea of phasors is often used to understand quantities that have phase differences between one another to see how things go as a function of time. At any rate, Ohanian does this on page 1047. If you do an engineering course, you'll probably really get into phasors, but I'm not going to press phasors all that much in this class. I sort of like thinking about it graphically like we have at the top of page 10, but I think if you get used to phasors, it's probably a pretty good way to do it. Well, so now we have the EMF going around the loop, and of course we can set this equal to 0 and see if we can solve for it. In an earlier edition of Ohanian, he did a pretty nice treatment using mathematics and trig IDs to basically find what the current and the phase angle have to be relative to the other pieces of the equation. The current version of Ohanian, I think, motivates a lot of it using phasors. At any rate, the details of it are complex and not necessarily all that important for us to get into. What is important, though, on page 11, is the form of the basic result. So let me remind you, if we go to page 8 and we look at the EMF going as a sine omega t, the current is equal to some I max times the sine of omega t plus phi, and what we have to determine is the size of the current and the phase angle. And if we now go back to page 11, having thought our way through how to do the EMFs as we go around the loop, and then we could solve for phi and for I max, and it's a bit nasty, so I'm not going to worry about it, but let's look at what the solution happens to be. And what we find is that the tangent of the phase angle, so this is the phase angle difference between the EMF and the current, goes as the inductive reactance minus the capacitive reactance over the resistance. It is a unitless thing because these reactances basically are acting like resistances in a circuit, so they have units of resistance. So that's the phase angle, or an equation for the phase angle. The second equation on page 11 is the equation for the maximum current, which is going to be the maximum EMF divided by this quantity in the radical, which is equal to R squared plus the square of the sum of the capacitive and inductive reactances. Again, we have the EMF max is proportional to I max. V is equal to IR, basically means this quantity, which I have put in pink brackets in the middle of page 11, plays the role of a resistance in an LRC circuit. And now, because we need yet another name, this is something which we call the impedance. Impedance is a word in English that basically means resistance, so it's a very nice word to use for resistance in physics. You can think of the impedance as resistance in the AC circuit. And if I write in the equation, which I have signified by the large A in a green circle, if I write down the impedance and I substitute in what the chi sub L and chi sub C are in terms of omega L and C, you get the form of the impedance Z. The symbol for impedance is Z. That I have written by the A in the green circle. All right. Now, impedance acts like resistance, which means the maximum current. You remember the current is changing in the circuit, but it has a maximal value. And that maximal value may change depending on omega, L, and C. And R, okay, all of these various quantities. So let's look at the behavior of this a little bit. Let's suppose that we have so we're at the bottom of page 11. Let us suppose that we have a sinusoidally varying EMF. That is varying with a frequency omega. Let's look at what happens to the impedance as, suppose I'm able to tune the EMF frequency, okay? So I can vary the way in which the loop rotates, which is generating my EMF, for example. I can change its frequency. Look at what happens to the impedance as the omega approaches the natural frequency, the natural LC oscillation frequency of the circuit. As omega approaches what I'll call omega zero, Z turns into the expression given beside the green B in a circle. The term, when this happens, you'll note that the sum of the capacitive and inductive reactances is zero. So, R in a circuit never is changing. That's hardcore resistance. But when you have the frequency approach the LC oscillation frequency in the circuit, the resistance that you're getting from the inductor and the capacitor basically go to zero. And what that means is that Z is minimized. If Z is minimized, then from our equation of I max equal to epsilon max over Z, I has to be maximized. So what we're saying is that the maximum I in a circuit is going to vary depending on how the circuit is made up. But if we suppose that we have a fixed capacitor and inductor in a circuit and a fixed resistance, and we're varying the sinusoidal frequency of the EMF, we're going to change the maximum current in that circuit. And in fact, it's going to peak, or it's going to be maximized when the frequency approaches the LC oscillation frequency in the circuit. You can actually think of this very much like you have forced oscillations in a mechanical system, and you hit resonance, which basically means the forcing frequency in the mechanical oscillation system approaches the natural frequency of the mechanical system, and that's the condition when you get resonance, which the amplitude of the oscillation starts getting crazy. Okay, starts going wild. So if we look at page 12, if we look at the current in the circuit as a function of omega, as omega approaches omega zero, then you'll get a peak in the current. And we say that the bandwidth of that particular peak is basically given by the way in which it turns on here. So you can design circuits so they have different bandwidths. But this is basically a resonance in the current. So I had a couple of people ask me of what earthly use are LC oscillation circuits. I mean, I think people thought it was sort of cool at the end of class last time, but I had two separate students come up and ask me after class, what can you do with this? Well, here's an example of what you can do with this. It's a way to construct a resonance in a circuit. So, for example, suppose you have something hitting your circuit with a sinusoidally varying EMF. If I go ahead a little bit, we know that electromagnetic waves are actually made of a sinusoidally varying electric and magnetic field. So if you have a little wire being hit by a radio wave, you can imagine that wire being hit by a sinusoidally varying EMF. I mean, that's a way to think about it. And if you now have within a circuit that includes that wire some sort of little LRC circuit, and you vary, for example, the capacitor or the inductor, you're effectively varying the natural LC oscillation frequency of the circuit. When you get the LC oscillation frequency to agree with the little sinusoidal frequency of that wave hitting the wire, you'll get what would be a negligible current then peaks, and you'll get a real current in the wire. So it's a way of making the current in your wire peak as you tune a dial, for example. So this is basically an idea of how to tune a radio. And I think there are lots of other powerful things we can do with this, and I've given you some example problems that hopefully you'll find useful, that will make use of this. Okay, so that's really all I wanted to cover on AC circuits. You'll have lots of nice homework and workshop problems to do on these. And I do want to remind you that AC circuits are not on the exam next Thursday. I'd like to turn now on page 13 to magnetic fields in matter. You know, we talked a lot about electric fields in matter in materials we call dielectrics. Of course, it's also important to understand how magnetic fields interact with matter. But to understand that, we have to think a little bit about what matter is. And you can think of atoms as potential current loops. And if we look at the behavior of a current loop in a magnetic field, on the left-hand side, imagine the XY plane being in the plane of your paper and the Z plane coming out at you. And let's suppose that we have a rectangular current loop which has an axis of rotation, which is the z-axis. So it can rotate about the z-axis, and which is perpendicular to the xy plane. So I try, and if we imagine that the current is going around in a certain direction, we know that the magnetic field can be given by the right-hand rule. So the magnetic field direction I will call mu, and mu is what we call the magnetic moment of a current loop. It's basically the current times the area of the loop. So mu represents the magnetic field of the current loop I, in a sense, is the magnetic moment of the current loop. I have an external magnetic field, which is given by the red arrow and the red B. If we have the z-axis actually poking into your eyeball, you get the left-hand curve, or left-hand plot at the top of 13. The axis of rotation is the z-axis, and what you see basically is the loop edge on. And so at the top half, if I go by the convention of how the current was moving in the left-hand side, the top part, the top half of the loop on the right-hand side has the current coming out at you, and the bottom half of the loop has the current going in. That's a little bit hard to say. Mu, because I have the loop at an angle with respect to the x-axis in this problem, mu is off to is also at an angle relative to the y-axis, the same angle. We can calculate the size of the torque on this loop. You can use the right-hand rule and convince yourself that for the current on the piece of the loop which is in the negative x, positive y quadrant, the force will be to the left. And for the piece of the loop, which on the right-hand graph on page 13, you would see in the negative y, negative x quadrant of the plane, the current is going in, so the force will be to the right with the magnetic field up. You can use the right-hand rule to convince yourself of this. So if we take the two directions of the forces that are shown by the red arrows on the right-hand side of page 13, you can see that what's going to happen when we have a current loop in a magnetic field is there will be a torque which is going aiming to align mu with B. And that actual torque can be given by mu cross B. And so that's conventionally the equation that we want to use, the equation that I have put in the big red circle on page 13 is an important equation that basically gives you the direction of the torque of on a current loop in a magnetic field. And it basically is a torque which will align the magnetic moment of the current loop with the magnetic field. Okay, so all of that is just a rather convoluted way of saying that if I have some randomly oriented current loop in a magnetic field, there'll be a torque on it which will attempt to align it with the magnetic field. So this is important when we consider matter, because it turns out that matter, you can think of it as being made of lots of current loops. Some types of atoms basically look like a current loop with no current, that is, they have no magnetic moment, and other types of atoms do have a magnetic moment. So there are three types of materials, roughly speaking, that we consider. One type of material is known as a paramagnetic material. This is a material where you can imagine that
all of the atoms are made up of little current loops, that in normal conditions, those current loops are in random orientations, and so there's no net magnetic field in the material. If we now put an external magnetic field on the material, we will align some of these little magnetic dipoles in the material. The stronger the field, the stronger the alignment, which means that in addition to the external magnetic field passing through the material, you have an additional magnetic field, which is a net field caused by the alignment of a bunch of these little dipoles. So the magnetic field strength in the material will actually increase, and it will increase proportional, it will be bigger, it will sort of amplify the external field, and it will be proportional, the magnification will be proportional to the magnetic field. There are is another type of material, which is known as a diamagnetic material, where you have no natural little dipoles in the material. And then a third type of material, are known as ferromagnetic materials. And the way to think about ferromagnetic materials is that the little dipoles are very strong. It's a ferro meaning iron. Okay, so think iron, but there are other materials that are somewhat ferromagnetic, but iron being the classic one. In a ferromagnetic material, you have strong magnetic dipoles in the material, and the way the lattice of the material is set up, you'll actually form regions within the material where the dipoles sort of align each other. But within the bulk material, these regions will be in random directions. Within each of the regions, so this would be the little graphical picture at the top right on page 14, within each of these little regions, you'll see some degree of alignment, and these little regions are known as domains. When we have an external magnetic field on a ferromagnetic material, you do have a torque acting to align many of these dipoles, and we'll see that basically what it means is that you begin to align the domains, and as you align the domains, you get a stronger magnetic field. In addition to the field, the external field, you have the field due to these dipoles. So it's a way of enhancing the field strength of the material. Okay. Maybe this is actually a good place to stop. Well, it's not so much, but I think I have to. I forgot to add a couple of slides in here, so I would have to take a break. So maybe it makes sense to just stop this lecture now. We'll come back to magnetic fields and materials for the next lecture. So I hope you've enjoyed the show, and hope it works out okay for you. Thanks for your undivided attention. Bye.